From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, Earthlings, or from wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, those open lines, what would you do if you had a second chance? That'll be our special hotline tonight. Tense times near San Francisco, investigators searching the smoldering rubble of a small, middle-aged, class neighborhood tucked into the hills overlooking San Francisco, looking for answers to why a gas line ruptured and fed a giant fireball that killed at least four people, injured 50. Firefighters finally contained the blaze Friday afternoon, but at least a quarter of the 15 acres of the charred homes were still too hot to search. Crews with dogs went house to house, and officials said that there could be more casualties from the blast. Homes were left with just chimneys, Stanley, and smoke still rose from the burned-out wreckage. Earlier this month, CoreLogic, that's a provider of information for financial and governmental institutions, released a report detailing the impact of the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill on home values in the coastal counties along the Gulf Coast. The affected areas, ranging from Mississippi to Alabama to the Florida Panhandle, face substantial losses over the next 5 years, according to their report. But what about the environment? What about the fish? Here's Dr. Robin Falco from Health Freedoms Rights. Robin, how bad is that situation?
Oh, gosh, George, the situation is really bad. We've been covering it on our own show and interviewing the locals in the area in Mississippi and in Alabama. And these people are putting their lives on the line, and they're sick and having symptoms and putting up videos of diseased crabs laden with parasites.
Oh, my gosh.
And oil, and yet the media is saying that it's safe for people to eat the fish and shellfish. It is just craziness.
You're very aware of the food you eat. So if you and Richard Hoagland went out to dinner one night and you knew that the seafood, the shrimp, whatever was from the Gulf of Mexico in that region, would you eat it?
No way. And we most definitely asked when we were in Flagstaff. I would never order the shrimp because I wouldn't trust them to tell me the truth. But when I asked the waiter in this restaurant, where does your shrimp come from? He said, the sea.
Oh, gosh. What's the biggest problem? It's not the oil. It's the chemicals they dumped in there, right?
Well, the chemicals are the corrosive that they've used to disperse the oil for cosmetic reasons. But the oil itself off gases, and with that intense humidity down there and the high heat, you've got this cloud laying over, you know, the land and the people, and spreading over to Florida and other areas. And the volatile organic chemicals, the benzene and the hydrogen sulfide and the toluene, I mean, these things cause severe illness, organ damage. Workers that are exposed to benzene in the workplace know that they're at great risk for acute myeloid leukemia, a blood cancer, many other cancers and diseases as well.
What's new at your website, healthfreedomrights.com?
Okay, what is new? I have the information up about my formula, the Gulf Oil Remedy, and I put a write-up there about the trip that I made to the Gulf on the 1st of June and why it was so important to have something that will help people that doesn't have side effects. It's a homeopathic, and that facilitates safe healing by stimulating the immune system.
All right, great. Thanks, Robin. You know, in a growing number of cities across the United States, local governments are placing computer chips in recycling bins to collect data on refuse disposal, and then they're fining residents who simply don't participate in recycling efforts, and they're forcing others into educational programs meant to instill respect for the environment. Now, from Charlotte, North Carolina, to Cleveland, from Boise, Idaho, to Flint, Michigan, the Green Police are spreading out. And that alarms some privacy advocates who are asking, should local governments have the right to monitor how you simply divide your paper cups from your plastic forks? Is that really the role of government? Lauren Weinstein with us. He's been involved with the development of the Internet for decades. Lauren, what do you think? This is getting a little ridiculous, isn't it?
It's a situation where I think everybody wants to support recycling in a reasonable way. And some of these projects where they're using various identification systems, and it doesn't really matter what you're using, whether it's a barcode or RFID, the point is that they want to identify the trash can and they want to weigh it. And when you're using these automated collection systems, it's easy to weigh them. And then you have a choice. Some cities are using incentives where if you participate in the program and you do lots of recycling, you get like points that you can redeem. And then you have cities like Cleveland, which are taking kind of the bad cop approach. And with them, if they detect that you have not taken out your recycling bin for some period of time, they will then inspect your trash.
Oh, my gosh.
They will go through it, and they will determine that if you have more than 10% recyclables, I guess you'll get a $100 fine or something. Now, there's a lot of unemployment, but that's one job that, you know, I wouldn't want to sign up for, to be going through the trash. Yep, this is 9.26%. This guy's okay, I guess. So it's really, the question really becomes, at what stage are you starting to go beyond the reasonable bounds of encouraging people to recycle and creating a punitive kind of atmosphere, which is, you know, kind of added to the feeling that a lot of people have right now that government's kind of getting too intimately involved in their lives. And once they're getting intimately involved in your trash, there's not too many other places to go.
What is this lunacy going to stop, Lauren?
Oh, I don't think it will. I think we're pretty well doomed in that respect, because if nothing else, most municipalities are desperate for funds, and any way they can find to collect additional funds is going to happen. Again, I think we all want to do recycling. I think that's a very important thing.
Of course, of course.
But the question is it being done with a carrot or with a stick? And my personal view is that incentive programs to encourage recycling are going to be much more effective than punitive programs, especially because with punitive ones, people are always going to find ways to game the system anyway. And you're probably going to spend more on enforcement in the long run than you're liable to collect. And certainly you'll be collecting a lot of bad will along the way.
All right. Thank you so much, Lauren. Lauren's website, too, will be part of our Twitter feed. You'll find it at coasttocoastam.com. A celestial event seen by the ancient Greeks may be the earliest sighting of Halley's Comet, according to new evidence. According to ancient writers, a large meteorite smacked into northern Greece between 466 BC and 467 BC. The writers also described a comet in the sky at the time the meteorite fell to Earth, but this detail has received little attention. Comet Halley would have been visible for about 80 days in 466 BC, according to the researchers. You know, over the past decade, there's been an ongoing debate over the threat posed by electromagnetic pulse, EMPs, to modern civilization, a debate that has heated up all over the place. William Forstchen, one of our guests on Coast to Coast, how bad is this situation, William? And are we talking about a nuke, or are we talking about a solar X-flare, or both?
George, it's great to be back with you, and as always, thanks for keeping up on this issue. It became a hot issue again within the last couple of days because of a Stratford report, which you can find online, that was very, very dismissive of the whole threat, both from terrorism and from a solar event. And sadly, I think it could have a very negative impact on a bill that is currently in the Senate to start preparing our infrastructure to be protected against such an attack.
And how much time do we have? I mean, this could happen at any time, right?
Well, George, you know what I mean when you read an article and suddenly just something leaps out at you and you go, wait a minute?
Yeah.
Okay, this report that just came out, a quick quote.
All right.
States, a nuclear weapon is seen as a deterrent by countries such as, listen carefully, North Korea or Iran, which seek such weapons simply to protect themselves from invasion, not to use them offensively.
Baloney.
Yeah, I have some other terms for that. A quote further on says that in this same article that an EMP attack would essentially be a non-lethal event, that terrorists would much prefer to use a nuclear weapon on a city like New York or Washington. A non-lethal event, I'd like them to think about that the next time they're flying in an Airbus or almost any commercial aircraft.
What do you recommend we do?
we got to stay hot and active on it. And what you're doing is part of it. House Bill 5026 went out of the House with full bipartisan support, went into the Senate, and guess what? It fell afoul of a committee. Is that surprising?
Unbelievable. All right, William, we'll stay on top of it. So will you, and you'll be back again. In the news at coasttocoastam.com, have you ever seen a 30-pound goldfish? I'm talking about this is something that would not fit in your little aquarium at all. Go take a look at the picture. It's a 30-pound, they call it a koi carp. It's still a goldfish, and it may be the biggest thing I've ever seen. Guy's holding it in his hands. It's huge. Okay, up next, we're going to the United Kingdom. Malcolm Robinson joins us as we talk about some very strange things going on this planet. Malcolm's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. It's going to be a great couple hours here. Malcolm Robinson, our guest, he's been interested in the strange world of the paranormal for as long as he can remember. In 1979, he formed his own research society entitled Strange Phenomena Investigations, SPI. And Malcolm is also the assistant editor of UFO Matrix magazine. His goal in life is simply to continue researching cases pertaining to the strange world of the paranormal and UFOs, and to hopefully provide some form of answer to account for what at present eludes all of us. Here's Malcolm. Malcolm, welcome. How are you?
I'm very well, George. Very well indeed.
And you're way out there in Scotland, are you?
Well, actually, I lived in Scotland most of my life. I'm now living in England at the very, very foot of the United Kingdom in a lovely little village called Hastings, right on the coast at the English Channel. And yeah, it's a lovely place. It's a great place in the world to be in.
If you were to drive from Scotland to England, how long would it take?
You're probably looking at a good 7.5 hours.
Oh, that's not bad. That's not bad, considering how far we drive in this country here in the United States.
Yeah,
that's not bad at all, but it's all pleasant. Is it overpopulated these days, or is it still pretty comfortable there?
It's very comfortable, yeah. I mean, Scotland is a wonderful, wonderful country, and I'm pretty sure a vast, substantial amount of your listeners have holidayed over there over the years. And, I mean, I still occasionally go up there to see family and relatives, etc., and just generally take in the good mood and area of the place, and, of course, the good alcohol.
You know, my take of Scotland, of course, was the Mel Gibson movie Braveheart, and tremendous movie. He played a great part there, too, and incredible heritage there, isn't it?
Absolutely. We're very, very proud of our heritage in Scotland. I mean, the sad thing is, to be honest with you, George, most of that film, Braveheart, was technically incorrect.
Really?
It did portray, yeah, absolutely. It did portray certain elements that was historically factual, but some were not. And I think you generally find that with most big blockbusters, historical blockbusters, that they'll tend to put salt and pepper and give it arms and legs just to make it more appealing, if you like, to the watching public. But that said, I mean, it did get through some of the true cases of Bannockburn, the Battle of Falkirk, and other aspects. And I feel that, you know, Mel Gibson played a fantastic role in that. He was very, very good as Scotland's William Wallace.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, tell me about your life in the paranormal, Malcolm. What happened? How did you get interested in this?
For me, George, it started as a very, very young boy. I was always interested in things strange, weird, and mysterious. And as I grew older, I started to read fictional accounts of ghost stories when I was a young boy. And then some family members started to give me books on what apparently were true accounts of ghosts. So I started reading all these accounts, and I must be honest, I mean, at that point, I thought, come on, you know, this can't be true. There are no such things as ghosts and poltergeists. And I set out on a crusade to disprove these subjects. Well, like anything else in life, once you get your hands dirty, once you physically spend nights in haunted houses, and believe you me, I've done many, many of that, you tend to come off the fence. I have seen things. I have been slapped. I have been kicked. I've had my hair pulled by nothing. Absolutely nothing.
I bet that region of the world is loaded with these bizarre, paranormal, ghostly stories. I mean, they've got to be everywhere.
Absolutely. And Scotland as a nation has also, you know, had many, many ghostly tales to tell. And for that matter, UFO sightings as well, some really, really good ones. And obviously, during the course of my investigative years, I set out to, as I say initially, to disprove it, but I found that these things were real. And like you said in your intro, in 1979, I set out to strange phenomena investigations. And the aims of SPI as a research group are to collect, research, and publish accounts relating to most aspects of strange phenomena and to purposely endeavour to try and come up with some answers to account for what at present eludes us. And I've been very, very fortunate to spend many nights in haunted houses and castles and buildings, and I am going to share some of these stories with your good self and your lovely listeners this morning. And where I am today is I firmly, on a personal level, I firmly believe in an afterlife. I think there is, for me and others, a continuity after physical material death. I've spoke with clinical physicians, people that's been in near-deathbed experiences, out-of-body experiences. But having said that, it would be absolutely foolish not to look at the other side of the coin. So we do look at potential answers. Maybe it's hallucinations, maybe it's drugs, maybe it's alcohol. So we always try to look and flip the coin over to look at the other side to see if any ghostly activity has a natural explanation, because it would be absolutely foolish not to do so. But in the main, most, if not all, of the cases I've researched do have a paranormal origin.
Do you find, Malcolm, that no matter where you go on this planet, whether it's in North America, the United Kingdom, Asia, Australia, no matter where you go, Africa, people are always fascinated with the unusual, with the paranormal? Is that the same everywhere?
It is, and it's certainly the case in Scotland and the United Kingdom as a whole. I mean, what we have to bear in mind is mankind, we're always learning, George. We're at the very, very bottom rung of an extremely long ladder of understanding. We laughed at Marconi, we laughed at John Logie Baird, we laughed at the Wright brothers, heavier air machines, man setting foot on the moon. But science is always, always, always progressing. We know so little about ourselves and our place in the cosmos. And I just don't understand why skeptics and debunkers say that these things don't happen. It's absolutely crazy, but you're correct, yeah. It's a global phenomenon. I mean, ghosts go back with us well into antiquity. But what we have to remember is there's quite a substantial amount of differences when it comes to ghosts. You have ghosts that are aware of you, ghosts that are looking at you, ghosts that will appear solid. You would actually pass them in the street. It sounds bizarre. There's quite a substantial amount of cases of that. Ghosts that will stop and navigate past furniture. You know, it's unbelievable. You've got crisis ghosts. I mean, for instance, some years ago during the Second World War, there was a lady in North London, I think it was 1942, 43, She was in her living room in North London, and she was knitting a jersey, and her son was fighting in the North Atlantic. He was on a ship in the North Atlantic. Now, that ship had been torpedoed by a Nazi U-boat, and suddenly the boat obviously exploded. Her son was thrown into the water, and he was flailing about in the water in the cold North Atlantic. And suddenly, he must have felt, "Mother, mother." And suddenly, back in London, this image is like a big television screen appeared in the room in North London, and the mother suddenly saw her son flailing about, you know. And that's what's known as a crisis ghost in an emergency and situations where very traumatic event has happened. Somehow a connection was made hundreds and hundreds of miles to the mother in London. And that's what makes it so exciting, is the differences in ghosts that we have.
Oh, that's fantastic. And Malcolm, stay with us. We're going to come back now and get into some of these incredible cases that have happened out there in the United Kingdom. And we'll go through them and have you tell us a little bit about them. Some of the stories are absolutely riveting. Malcolm Robinson, our special guest for the next couple hours. We'll take phone calls with him next hour. author of Paranormal Case Files of Great Britain, Volume 1, and UFO Case Files of Scotland as well. His website, he's got a couple of them linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. I'll double duty for Ian Punnett this weekend. Saturday, his guest is Tom Cromer as they talk about toxic chemicals and what's happening with the environment. And then on Sunday, just a neat little program, a child's imagery friend could be a ghost talking about what might be under the bed. Get ready for that. And when we come back, more with Malcolm Robinson as we talk about strange paranormal cases out there in the United Kingdom. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. We're with Malcolm Robinson. Malcolm, let's start with the Sauky poltergeist case. What is that one?
Yeah, the Sauky poltergeist case is one of the biggest cases ever to have occurred in Bonnie, Scotland. It happened way back in 1961, and very briefly what happened was that a family came over from Ireland, from Donegal in Ireland, to live in the small town of Sauky, which is in central Scotland. Now, the little girl that this poltergeist affected, her name was Virginia Campbell, and she really didn't want to leave Ireland. She had family and friends there. She had a little dog over there, and she didn't really want to come to Scotland. However, the family uprooted, and they travelled over, and they settled into their house in this small town. Now, no sooner had they settled into this house than strange and bizarre events began to unfold. Firstly, there were knockings on the wall, there were rappings on the bed itself, and there was all these noises, rappings, horrible burning smells pervading the whole house. It didn't just stop at the house. Incredibly, it even went to a local school, a little primary school. And on one occasion, the teacher looked up from her desk at the front of the class, and she looked up right across the classroom and saw that one of her pupils, that is Virginia, had her arms forcibly trying to push down on the lip of this desk, the desk lid. And she says, "Virginia, what are you doing?" "Nothing, miss, nothing. Leave, stop that. Put your arms away." So Virginia took her arms off the desk, and the desk lid was flap, 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 up and down, and then it rose. The desk rose a couple of inches in full view of all her classmates and also the teacher as well, up into the air. And on another occasion, Virginia approached their school teacher. And this is back in 1960, George. In Scotland, we had the big long desks and the tall wooden cane, teacher's cane, which she pointed to the large big blackboard. And Virginia approached the teacher with her schoolwork, her essays, and put it down on her desk. Seconds later, the large school cane, the big pointer, started to vibrate on the table. Then it stood up. It stood up vertically and started bang, bang, banging on the table again. And in full view of all the terrified classmates, if that wasn't enough, this large, heavy oak table lifted a couple of inches off the floor and started to rotate very, very slowly. And whereas before, the teacher was, her stomach was in part of the long, end of the table, it turned round where the narrow end of the table was then in front of the teacher's stomach. Now this, it sounds preposterous, it sounds crazy, it's like something out of a Steven Spielberg movie, but this was witnessed by over 50 classmates of Virginia Campbell. And soon the local doctor and minister got involved because it really was traumatic what was happening in this family home. The doctor attended Virginia and she was lying in her bed, and suddenly he saw the pillow next to Virginia as she was laying in bed depressed down, as if another person, an invisible person's head, had indented into the pillow. And then in the bedroom, a heavy linen chest rose up several inches off the floor and started thump, thump, thumping down. And so much happened in that particular case. It was unbelievable. It drew the attention, obviously, of the local newspapers and in the national newspapers, and it went worldwide. And to date, this is unequaled in the annals of poltergeist phenomena, not only in Scotland, I guess, but certainly within the rest of the United Kingdom. But as a tail note, George, the family up sticks and they moved off to somewhere down in England. And sadly, we don't know where they went, because I would love, absolutely love, to get back in touch with that family, purely just to see if anything else is happening, if everything's subsided. And equally, I mean, a new family obviously has moved into that poltergeist house, and it's, as a researcher, George, you sometimes wonder when you go back to a haunted house, knock on the new occupant's door, you know.
I'm not sure I'd go back, Malcolm.
Yeah, this is the thing, you know, and knock on the door and say to the new occupant, you know, are you getting any bother there? It's one of these things that's difficult to do, but it was a very, very bizarre case, that one, for sure.
How many cases have you investigated or checked into?
I would certainly say well over 300, easy.
Oh, my.
It doesn't maybe sound a lot, but believe you me, with all the time and effort one puts into a case, I mean, what happens, George, is that we get our cases from either word of mouth or from newspapers or from radio stations, and we'll try and ascertain if perhaps it's just a mickey take, if they're trying to pull the wool over eyes. And if we're convinced of the sincerity of the people who are reporting these cases, then we will take in a qualified psychic medium. And we've worked with some of the best mediums in England, and when she walks into this house, I'll look at her. I'll look at her face, and as soon as she nods, a little gentle nod, I know. I know that we're onto a good thing here. But if she just turns and shakes her head, basically it means that she's not picking up anything. And we ask the occupants of the house if it's okay for our team to spend the night in their home with video recorders, infrared recorders, mm-hmm. all the equipment, you know.
Have you ever captured anything?
Well, on one occasion, we were in this haunted house, and we were in this haunted bedroom, George, and all the equipment was running, and we always work in darkness, and nothing was happening, absolutely nothing was happening, and it was at times like this, I say to myself, you know, why do I do this? Then suddenly, the whole room illuminated in thousands and thousands of tiny pinpricks of white light, like a children's sparkler, a handheld sparkler that one gets in the UK on November the 5th. It was sparkling lights all over the room, all over the ceiling, the walls, the floor, all over your clothes. And I turned round and I said to a psychic, what on earth is this? What is this? And she very calmly says, Malcolm, that's pure psychic energy. Now, about 25 seconds later, it was like a dimmer switch on your wall in your home. Just turn, 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 turn. Slowly, this light just, you know, it was gone. It was gone. It just suddenly was not there anymore. So we, with fingers crossed, we went to the VCR recorders, pressed stop, pressed rewind, and hoped upon hope that we had captured this phenomenon. We pressed play, and it was blackness. We hadn't captured this wonderful, spectacular light show. And the thing is, George, even if we had have captured it, would Joe Public, would Joe Skeptic have believed us? He may have said, Malcolm, you know, wonderful evidence, but did you do that in Photoshop? Did you do that on your computer?
Sure,
hey, man,
yeah.
Anybody can do that, you know. And that's the sad thing, George. We're living in the Steven Spielberg age of DreamWorks Laboratory, where anything can be manipulated onto computer screen to look magical. But thankfully, you know, that same technology can be applied to a UFO photograph, a ghost photograph, to say, you know, make sure it is the real deal.
But 20 years ago, you couldn't do that.
Absolutely. And one of the best ghost photographs coming from the United Kingdom is the Raynham Hall ghost photograph. And that shows an image, the contours of a woman gliding down the stairs of the stately home, Raynham Hall in Norfolk. And this was captured by two gentlemen who physically actually saw those ghostly apparitions gliding down the stairs. They managed to capture it on one of these old box cameras, and it stood the test of time. Even Kodak, one of the big manufacturers of film, etc., they analyzed that and they said, you know what? We can't see any sign of trickery or fakery here. And you see a picture as tells a thousand words, you know, but at the end of the day, a lot of your listeners who listen to your show on a regular basis have been touched by the paranormal. They know in their heart of hearts that what they have seen, they have seen. And it's all down to faith, I guess. You know, they say that, you know, for me personally, when you see things, I think that's when you come off that skeptical fence.
Malcolm, so many cases, like you said, you've looked at 300 plus. Let's go through a couple more here while we still have some time. Tell me about the shoe through the window case. What the heck was that?
Well, as a young boy, I had my own paranormal experiences. And as a young boy, I was around about 5 or 6 years of age. My mother had came home with a pair of shoes for me to wear. And she says, Malcolm, look, I've got you a lovely pair of shoes here. And I didn't like them, George. As a young rebellious boy, I just didn't like them. And I says, I don't like them. And I took these shoes and I threw them down towards a settee in the living room. And, George, they were definitely, definitely going towards the settee. No bones about it. I threw them down very forcibly. They stopped in midair for about a second or two. Then they slowly moved up in midair and went right through the living room window, smashed right through the window. And I couldn't believe what I was looking at. And I remember my father saying when I was growing up, he says, son, my mother, as you know, died. She passed the spirit a few weeks ago. But I'm going to tell you something. Excuse me. He said that when she had died, a few days later, he says, I was lying in my bed, and suddenly, in the darkened room, I heard, Robert, Robert, look at me. And my father said to me, son, I knew that that was my mother, your gran, but she had died. She had died a few days previously. And there was a beautiful, warm glow pervading the whole of the room. And he knew it was his mother, but he didn't look at her. Now, the story goes that she appeared to his brothers that same night. And his brothers, my uncles, did look at her. And his brother said she looked absolutely beautiful. She looked radiant. And she said, I've passed on. I'm just going to a better place now.
I've passed on. Simple as that, right?
Simple as that, yeah.
Jeez. All right.
But the thing is, I mean, at the end of the day, a lot of these stories that I've had growing up, and I've had quite a few, was more or less the fuel to the fire of my passion for the burning desire to try and get some more information about what is going on. And I remember another case. There was, when I was working in Scotland, a lot of my workmates saw the passion that I had for the paranormal. And one of my workmates said to me, Malcolm, you're crazy. You're absolutely crazy. There's no such things as ghosts and poltergeists and UFOs. But I'll tell you what, Malcolm, when I pass myself, which God forbid not for many, many years, if there is such a thing as the afterworld, afterlife, I'll come back and let you know. Now, many, many years passed, George, and I completely forgot, obviously, about that conversation.
Mm-hmm. The deal, and right?
Absolutely, yeah. And I got up for what's known as a day shift. I got up at 5 in the morning to start my work at 6 in the morning. And the house was very, very quiet. Everybody was sleeping up the stairs. And I went down into the kitchen and I put on the kettle for a cup of tea. And then suddenly, you just get that sensation that somebody is standing behind you. It was very, very powerful, very strong. And I slowly, slowly turned around and saw nothing.
Nothing?
Nothing.
But you felt it. You knew it.
I knew it, absolutely. Now, when I went to my work, I went into the men's mess room, where you go before you conduct your work. And all my fellow workmates had their heads hanging down. And I says, what's the matter with you? Come on, boys, what's the matter with you? Oh, Malcolm, have you not heard? Heard what? Oh, Bobby Smith died last night. And that was the gentleman, George, who said many, many years ago, if there ever, ever, ever such a thing as the afterlife. Boy, I'll come back and you'll know it. Now, George, I didn't see him, but by golly, I felt something very, very in the kitchen that morning, very sure.
Malcolm, why do you think it's the interest in the afterlife that affects so many people? Is it because we're all gonna, you know, meet our maker one day?
Well, it's a big, big question. I mean, I'm a spiritualist myself. I do believe in life after death. There is, I guess, when all's said and done, there is this desire by humankind to believe in an afterlife, that this cannot be at all, that there must be more to this than meets the eye. I mean, man has always held this deep fascination for the afterlife. Neanderthal burials of more than 50,000 years ago, and also the Egyptian mummification process, was done in the hope, if not belief, that those who passed on would survive. Now, as you know, Christianity and the teachings of Jesus Christ also play a big, big role in this belief system, because Jesus himself stated, "I am the resurrection and the life, and he who believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live." But the thing is, a belief is one thing, but can there be any truth in the existence of an afterlife? And this is why myself and my colleagues worldwide are trying to find validity to the possibility that there is indeed this otherworldly existence. And how do you do it? Is it photographs? Is it EVP recordings? Is it your own testimony? What constitutes the evidence that there is this life after death? It may be one or them all. But I think it comes from your own self. It comes from the human being himself. I'll be honest with you, I don't think we'll actually prove it with any substance to the skeptics, but my research and investigations of over 35 years have shown to me personally, George, for me it's real.
That's right. And by the way, did you go down in a submarine in the Loch Ness to look for Nessie?
You bet you. You bet you I did. It was back in 1994. I mean, I've been a Scotsman. It would be sad if I didn't research the Loch Ness phenomenon. And I remember, again, as a young boy, my father, you know, enthralled me by these tales of this water beastie that inhabited the murky waters of Loch Ness. So some years later, when I was a teenager, I went up to Loch Ness, I investigated, and I interviewed many, many, many people who lived around the shores of Loch Ness, people who knew the moods of the loch. They saw the wind, the water waves, they saw the birds who dived into the water. They knew the conditions, they were not fooled. But back in 1994, I was very fortunate to go down in the submarine. It was sponsored by Swatch Watches, and it was a North Sea submersible. It went down to check oil pipes in the North Sea. And it was 35 feet in length, very small. And they were taking members of the public down to Loch Ness, to the bottom of Loch Ness, for £68.50 British money.
That's pretty murky down there, isn't it?
It's very murky. I mean, Loch Ness is heavily peat-stained by the peat particles coming off the hills at the side of the loch. And you really cannot see anything in Loch Ness. You know, you could put your hand in there and shine a torch or a light and you wouldn't see anything. But thankfully, this submarine had about 7 or 8 very, very powerful, strong halogen lights, a massive big light source on the front nose of the submarine. The submarine had a very toughened glass portal.
Hey, Malcolm, we're at the top. Did you see Nessie?
I didn't, but I had some wonderful experiences down there. Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Malcolm. He didn't see Nessie, but it could have been close. Malcolm Robinson, Paranormal Case Files of Great Britain. I'll be back.